Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Innovation Office Hours with John Gardner. This is John Gardner. I am really pleased today to be in conversation very shortly here with a gentleman that I can't tell you how long I've known him. I don't know why I can't. I just don't have memory implanted as to when I first met Dr. Stephen Handel, but I know what he was doing and what I was doing. This was way back when I was at the University of South Carolina, and Dr. Handel was working for the College Board, and he had several significant roles in that nearly century-year-old nonprofit organization, and he also has been the chief admissions for both undergraduate and transfer students to unquestionably the most prestigious research system of higher education in the United States, the University of California. And more recently, Steve has gone to work for an organization he may or may not, if he chooses to, tell you more about, the ECMC Foundation, which I must disclose, the Gardner Institute has received financial support from. That's not related to why I want to talk with him, and I'm not going to ask him to talk about any of our work, I promise you, listeners who still respect me. So this is a gentleman who's been both inside and outside the academy, and now he invests and he recommends that his foundation invest in the kind of work that many of us in follow this series are interested in, and that is strategies to improve student success. And he's seen a lot of these strategies, and he gets to hear about a lot that want his support. So I think he's really an expert on, you know, what I'm most interested in talking about. So, Steve, let me turn this over to you, and I'd like you to give our listeners, and you will, I promise you, have listeners, what should they know about you to put you in context? Give us a kind of big picture overview of you in any way you deem appropriate.
Well, thanks, John. It's great to be here. Always great to have an opportunity to talk with you and also to do work with your organization. Gosh, about me, you know, I've been in higher education my entire so-called career. I've worked only in, though, about three places. Started at the University of California with the Office of the President, oh, so very long ago, but right smack in the middle of the Regents' decision back in 1997 to dismantle affirmative action in California. So I was squarely in the middle of that, those discussions, but continued to work with the university until I moved over to the College Board in the mid-2000s, was with them about 9 years, then went back to the University of California as their chief admissions officer for the system. And then finally now, as you mentioned, here with ECMC Foundation, which is located in Los Angeles, although I'm up here in the Bay Area. To summarize all of that, John, seriously, it's been a career focused on higher education. It's been focused on underserved students and the extent to which our traditional academy does or does not live up to its particular mission about bringing all segments of the American population into higher ed. You know, I benefited greatly from the California Master Plan. I'm a California boy, and that Master Plan provided me, from a lower income family, the opportunity to go to college, to earn my master's, to earn my PhD. And that came through the investment of the state, came through the investment of the citizens there. And so my work has always been to sort of bring that back, to continue to make the argument that higher education is worth the investment, both in California and abroad. So that, in a nutshell, is pretty much what I've been doing, and I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it greatly, and we can talk more about any of those particular organizations or the work that they do as you deem appropriate.
Well, I think some of our listeners may not know anything about the Master Plan, but it so influenced many subsequent innovative practices. Please give us just a recapture that, because it's, you know, you think historically, ladies and gentlemen, I got to confess, Steve and I are, we tend to see our work in higher education and how it's influenced by the history of the United States and where we are on that historical continuum. That's one of my affinities with Steve. So you mentioned the master plan. Just tell us quickly how that was created, why, and how that influenced you.
Yeah, it has great relevance for a lot of states right now, but this is in the late 50s. California is booming, baby boomers and the post-war prosperity, and Clark Kerr and others, who at the time was head of the University of California, worked with Governor Brown, the first Governor Brown, to sort of say, we have got to accommodate this surge of students in California. How will we do it? And they essentially, you know, routinized the process of admissions for community colleges, for the California State University system, and for the University of California, figuring out ways to make investments in those systems, independent systems, such that they would work together, that they would work more effectively. And in many ways, that master plan has influenced a lot of higher education policy around the country. The area that I was particularly interested in, and we'll talk more about this, John, at least I hope so, is the relationship between community colleges and four-year institutions. This is 1960, and while community colleges had been around for, gosh, at that point, 60 or 70 years, the transfer process was largely haphazard, particularly in California. And what the master plan did was say, no, this is an important, in fact, a key route for underserved students to make their way from a community college to a baccalaureate degree, whether that be at Cal State or the University of California. And that particular pathway has only been strengthened, I think, over the subsequent decades. So for me, that was one of the key aspects of it, accepting the fact that California has a great diversity of students, great diversity of income, and that students will enter higher education at different stages with different kinds of goals. And that, I'm sure, John, you have to believe is even more important today in higher ed.
Steve, did you start in a California community college?
I did, yeah, Cosumnes River College in South Sacramento. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it was so long ago. A lovely, wonderful way to start college. It was an affordable way to start college. I felt so very well treated, and then transferred to Cal State Sacramento, and then ultimately off to UCLA for my graduate work.
I should have said, perhaps in my introduction of you, that the area of work, and Steve, you're just really telling us this, is that Steve and I have most converged around is what sadly both of us think is probably the worst performing sector of American higher education or component, which is the transfer phenomena. And Steve and I are both champions for what has never been a high enough priority. Steve, I want to credit you publicly. It was your introducing me to more of the details of the history of American higher education, which you did when I was a student in a room with you in the year 2012, about how community college education in this country was really designed to keep people out of other sectors, and what a good job it did. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, because even though it's embarrassing for me to acknowledge this about our country, you've made me very aware that it was real and it is real.
Yeah, I mean, it's been such an important part of my work, and here's the at least interesting for me. So I was coming from a highly selective research institution and trying to champion the greater admission of students from California community colleges. And that's a kind of a strange position to be in, because community colleges in many ways are disconnected, I think, from the more elite institutions across the country. That has changed, certainly at the University of California, but at a lot of our public flagships. I think they realize that there's a great deal of diversity, both income, racial, ethnic, in our community colleges, and that we have to do a better job about thinking about how we make those connections. But even beyond that, community colleges are a model, I think, for this new century, right? They are low cost. They are geographically accessible. And they do a lot of things that that we're going to need to do more of. One of them is connect students more effectively towards the local economy, towards the local workforce, as well as accommodate those students who feel like they want a baccalaureate degree and to use that ticket to move on into professional school or into graduate education. Community colleges have always played that important multi-factor role. Some better than others, admittedly. But when you have institutions as important as that, I think you really have to support them. And that's one thing I don't think states have done very well, honestly. It's the least well-resourced, least well-resourced institutions in higher education, and yet often dealing with the most challenged students. Why do I say that? Well, they don't have admissions requirements. You know what? Community colleges open their doors to anyone who believe that they can benefit from the programs and services there. So you're going to have you're going to have folks with a lot of different skill levels, and that's a real challenge. Yet community colleges are often not funded to sort of accommodate those students in ways that would make them most effective. And I'll simply end with the idea that a lot of community colleges get a lot of criticism for completion rates, and I certainly don't want to candy coat those. But on the other hand, I also have to believe that when you are opening your doors to everyone, it takes some real resources to be able to move people through that system in a way that leads to credential completion, degree completion, transfer, what have you. So I've always been a big believer in community colleges, but I've also understood some of the inherent limitations those institutions have just by the way in which they were created and the way in which they're now funded.
Well, Steve, because I know you think this way, I've got to get you to talk about this. Here we are, 2024, in the midst of a presidential election, a country that's very divided. On a scale here of looking at this pendulum of the history of community colleges and where we are now, what's your prediction about where this is it? Well, not a prediction, a statement of where it is now, but where you believe it will go.
That's a great question, John, because my co-writer and I, Eileen Strempel, who is the Dean of Music at UCLA, we've been writing together for a long time, and we've been focused on community colleges most of that time during that writing. And we have been grappling a little bit with, you know, what is the state of transfer right now? We've both been in it for three decades. You know, where are we seeing progress, and yet where are we seeing still sort of persistent challenges? And that's what we are sort of trying to get our arms around right now. In the area of, you know, sort of positive approaches, we see, for instance, a great deal more interest on the part of states and four-year institutions in creating transfer pathways that are workable for students. I think both political leaders as well as four-year institutions appreciate that perhaps they haven't spent the kind of time they need to spend on those campuses to understand what those particular needs are. So I think that's all been good, but I don't think it's been sufficient. We see a lot of state policy around, you know, routinizing transfer processes or creating common course numbering. I think all that's good, but it's not transformative. If we look at transfer rates, gosh, 30 years ago, and we look at transfer rates now, honestly, I don't know that they've budged all that much. I don't know that we've made the kind of transformational change, both at two-year institutions and four-year institutions, that could really ramp up the number of students that actually make that transition between a two-year and a four-year. Now, let me also say, John, a lot of people will say, well, Steve, you're sort of stuck in that old world, two-year to four-year, lateral transfer. Those are the old days. Students transfer all over now. And I completely agree. So I don't want to undermine or disparage that part of the higher education system. Yes, we're going to see more students moving from institution to institution. But the two-year to four-year has particular resonance for me because it was designed to accommodate students who might not otherwise be able to be number one in higher education or number two ever earn a baccalaureate degree. You know, I've had the good fortune to travel around the world, and this notion that anybody can go to college at any time is pretty radical. In fact, I've said more than once, and to you, community colleges are maybe the grandest experiment in American higher education. There is no elitism there. There is no, you're not quite good enough there. You can go to college. Now, you got to put in the work, and you've got to assert yourself in that. But that's astonishing. So what I'm saying is that pathway has always held an important part of my life, and I think for those important reasons. What does the future look like, John? I don't know. Coming out of a pandemic, you know, we have a really wonderful opportunity to remake higher education in ways that I think Americans want. I mean, I think more Americans are skeptical right now of you know, the benefit of higher education. Certainly, it's more expensive. I think a lot of our prospective students coming out of high school are wondering if making that kind of investment is important. So all that to say, we've done good work in transfer. We have strengthened it, but there, gosh, there's so much more we need to do.
Absolutely. Well, that's a lot of what my work is about and yours. Colleagues out there in our audience, I was musing with Steve before we began this conversation that increasingly those of us who advocate for some of these kinds of changes in American higher education are facing more criticism, and he just referenced the skepticism. But I'm finding, Steve, that thankfully a number of the foundations who invest in higher education are showing more courage now and are staying the course in terms of these kinds of commitments than many of our institutions. Now, how do you feel about what you, well, I don't want to put words in, but let me put this in the form of a question. Do you see what I see, which is a dramatic retreat from these, from institutional commitments to equity and all things?
Well, I mean, right now it's a very fraught time, very, very fraught. And it's hard to know who's listening to who. Sometimes I do wonder whether or not Americans can sit down for a time and just try to listen, as it were, across the aisle. Listen, reasonable men and women can differ. They ought to differ. That's why it's America. However, it's not clear to me that we're listening to one another very effectively. In higher ed, there are some real challenges, no question, and questions around commitment to equity, commitment to diversity, I think are things I thought that were resolved, honestly, are back on the table again. I don't have any answers for that other than to keep plugging away to talk about what the value is of higher education for not only individuals, but for the nation. And we have to demonstrate that. And the way in which I've been at least advancing it is we demonstrate this by doing the things we need to be better at, which is degree completion. You know, we have to do a much better job of getting students the credentials and the degrees that they're working towards, that they're investing in. We haven't done a very good job of that, but it is possible to do. There are pockets of great success in closing equity gaps, in closing completion gaps, not at the expense of others, but at the benefit of the institution and the individuals. So this is not beyond us. And I think if higher education does do a better job of doing that, then higher education will, I think, turn around, at least in the eyes of many Americans, in terms of what it's supposed to do, which is, again, to provide individuals, but also the country with a knowledgeable citizenry that can actually run the operation when all of us are retired and gone. But you're right, John. I think there are grave threats to higher ed, and we've got to continue to work to make the value case for higher ed.
So, Steve, and you may be already partially answering this, if you could fund every institution in America, what would you be giving us resources to do? What should we be doing? Assuming that we, at least many of us, make the case that we don't have these resources, I question that. As a matter of fact, I have long viewed a lot of the gifts we've received from private sources are for things we should have been doing anyway, and we just never allocated the resources. Shame on us. But what would you have us do? I think, you know, even if it's stating the obvious, Steve, as I often say, the most obvious things in life need to be said more frequently. So what must we be doing?
You know, again, I'm going to reiterate the whole notion around completion. You know, I think in some ways, and again, we both came from 4-year, research institutions. I think that's our tradition. We know how those places go. And not for a moment do I want to disparage any of the good work in terms of research and community service that a lot of those elite institutions are engaged in daily. And in fact, a lot of 4-year institutions. But put that aside, let's take a look at completion rates across the country. You know, they're just above 60%. And that's with a very generous bar of, I think, 6-year completion. I do wonder what happened to 4-year completion and 6-year completion, but I think it's been pretty generous. Now, some people will say, well, you know, it's a different world. Students don't have the kind of income or the resources to sort of engage in full-time enrollment and to get a degree in 4 years. And I completely get that. But I think there is a time for higher education to insist upon itself that admitting students alone just isn't going to do it. We have wonderful access to higher education in California, but as well as around the country. Honestly, that's not an issue. The issue is, what are they coming out with? You know, we know that at least 40 million Americans have some college, but no degree. I think that was the last statistic from the Clearinghouse. What does that say? Well, for me, it says some folks tried higher education and decided they either didn't want to continue or could not continue. And that reflects badly on higher ed. Now, this is not to absolve, you know, individual cases are in fact individual. I get that. But 40 million Americans, some college credit, yet no credential or degree. That's astonishing. And that means, well, I think something's wrong in the mechanics, either in the way in which, you know, when we offer courses, how we offer courses, where we offer courses, the way in which the pedagogy is designed. Maybe it's in the assessment as well. It's probably all of those things. But John, that's where I think we're going right now is to provide those kinds of opportunities. So students come out with that credential or that degree, which we know the research is pretty unassailable, is key to not only economic advancement for individuals, but also for their engagement, frankly, in their communities and their ability to raise families and to be a contributing member of those communities. So, you know, I keep talking like it's as simple as that. I know it's not simple, and I know my colleagues on campuses are trying to close those gaps. But that needs to be the focus, I think, right now. Certainly,
let's talk about these
10 to 15 years.
You and I have been looking at a more macro level, somewhat more abstract, but obviously we're going to have educators doing this work. And as you look at people who are making significant differences in doing the kind of work you want to invest in and you respect, talk to us about characteristics and behaviors and practices that describe successful innovation as you're seeing it in American higher education now, because I know you are.
So, you know, here at ECMC Foundation, I've been with them for a couple of years. They're not an old foundation. They've been around since about 2015. And I joined because you're right. They are focused precisely in what are the practices, what are the policies, what are the ideas that can enhance higher education to better serve students, but to better serve students who have been traditionally underrepresented in higher education. You know, we're very interested in ideas that are scalable, ideas that aren't just going to happen at one institution because of its unique location or its, you know, its unique faculty quality, but ideas that can scale, and ideas that that can scale effectively for all students. I will tell you, and this has been in the news as well, and we're not the only funder, but I know that the American Council on Education, large organization, has been focused very much on revising the Carnegie classifications, and they're working diligently in that area. And I bring that up; their work is still ongoing. But I think one of their sort of models of action is, what are the incentives in higher education that keep us, frankly, from moving towards better completion rates? Are we rewarding institutions in ways that allow them to make that shift, to focus that effort? And so I think, John, one will be incentives like that. And I think that's how higher education operates, just like a lot of businesses and not-for-profits. Secondly, we're going to have the regular and ongoing input of our political leaders as well, not just because they hold the purse strings, but because policy like that can be used, I think, effectively, not punitively, but in terms of incentives. And then the third area, and I think this is particularly true of higher of the transfer process, is technology. Now, I've been involved in a lot of technology projects over my career, and honestly, most of them didn't work out like we hoped. They cost a lot of money, and they didn't really end up being the things that they had hoped they would be. I know there's a lot of concern about machine learning right now, about artificial intelligence, but I'm also encouraged by the notion that there may be economies of scale within these technologies that allow us to get to a place where we can help students, particularly in the area of credit mobility, understand better what their trajectory looks like. So, example, why don't we have, for instance, online resources scaled across states even that provide students not only with a clear and unambiguous interpretation of how their credits will transfer from one institution to another, but more generally, what are the sort of degree scenarios that they might put in place? Student has 30 units at a community college, say, and they'd like to be an engineer, and they'd like to be an engineer at a particular institution. Well, what would that take? How much would it cost? You know, that can't possibly be beyond some of the technologies that are being developed right now. And I bring that up because I think transfer is the most complex place in higher education when we're talking about completion. So here's students who have to, they're not going to get the baccalaureate generally at a community college, so they have to transfer. We don't advise students to transfer in the middle of their undergraduate careers. We certainly don't tell kids at Harvard to transfer in the middle of their undergraduate careers. Why? Because that's hard and because you lose credit and because it's just a pain in the ass. But community college students have to. So what are the techniques? What are the technologies that will allow us to give them agency, to give them the wherewithal to make their own decisions right now? Yes, counselors are going to be key. Advisors are going to be key. But John, we're never going to have enough advisors for every transfer student or every student who wants to transfer. So I think in my view, I think what the future holds is greater, if we can create greater agency on the part of students, we will in fact, because they're self-motivated, right, to earn a degree, to earn a credential. But if we can give them the right tools, I think part of the completion puzzle can be solved. But call me an optimist.
Thank goodness, because pessimists wouldn't be giving colleges the kind of support and encouragement that you couldn't it be argued? And I wonder, do you ever argue this to yourself, that ultimately the way we have to solve this is by making transfer less necessary, which would mean making it more possible for students to complete, fulfill their degree or credential aspirations at the institution where they enter and not having to go through this, and hence the so-called community college baccalaureate movement?
Yeah, I've done a lot of thinking about that. I think you're right. I think there's two parts of that. One is, I think we would all agree that if you are able to stay at a single institution and do your credential or your degree there, I think that's the best of all worlds. A transfer is a wonderful mechanism, but I agree, John, that if a student could locally stay local, go local, get the degree local, like it works. But I think what we're also seeing, particularly coming out of the pandemic, is the opportunity to take a lot more credit online, to take a lot more credit from a variety of providers. And I think that's a good thing as well. So we're going to see more credit movement. We're going to see more opportunities for students to earn college credit. Gosh, look at the dual enrollment phenomenon in community colleges right now. It's just going through the ceiling. I mean, we're seeing huge enrollments. In fact, one of the statistics, and I think it came from our friends at the Community College Research Center, about, you know, 1 in 5 students who are in dual enrollment are high school students. So we're gonna see a lot more credit out there, and we're gonna have to grapple with the notion that students are gonna be bringing that credit in a lot of different ways. I have struggled a little bit with transfer in the sense of this transfer pathway, and I think there are places. I think Florida is an example, other states as well, where the community college baccalaureate movement has taken hold and is accommodating regions, sectors that need trained individuals in particular areas. So I think we're going to see more of it. I think we're also going to see, John, more four-year institutions offering intermediate credentials, associate's degrees, credentials.
Which they used to do. It was very widespread in the 60s and 70s. It's virtually disappeared.
Right. So I think we're going to see more flexibility along those lines as well. So all of those things, I think, are the higher education ecosystem in America is designed chaotic's too strong a word, but it's designed to be diverse, right? We don't have a ministry of education. We don't want a ministry of education. We want the diversity of institutions and the diversity of ideas and the things that they provide. However, what comes from that, of course, is particularly for underserved students, a real necessity to be a kind of professional as you dive into it, because it is so complex at times. And so our obligation, I think, in a very diverse environment like that, is we've got to develop the tools for students to be able to navigate that complexity in ways that are effective and low cost.
You know, when you talk about baccalaureate institutions offering what you called intermediate credentials, as in associate degrees, and when I came to my university, we were doing that, then we got rid of it, and I don't know that we'll ever bring it back. But assuming we do, some universities are. At the same time, community colleges offering more and more bachelor's degrees. Aren't we seeing then a convergence phenomena where the 2-year becoming more like the 4-year becoming more like the, and so in effect, the whole system may be changing itself and becoming more comfortably porous.
I like that, comfortably porous. We are seeing that. But part of that's driven by demand, right? I mean, part of that is driven by the idea that we need, for instance, more nurses. We, you know, need more teachers. We need, and community colleges being so geographically accessible are willing to step up and say, yeah, we're gonna give that a try. Listen, in California, you know, I mean, I adore the University of California. They've got 9 wonderful campuses. But they're not going to build a bunch more of those. They're too expensive, and they like what they've got. So they're not, you know, they're not going to be able to expand or be as accessible as the 100 and so community colleges are already in California. So I agree. I think we're going to see a lot more interaction among institutions to sort of achieve some of the needs for states and for regions that are critical, and that perhaps only community colleges can provide.
You have vast experience with all levels and sectors of American higher education, so you know well that many of the rewards in terms of upward mobility come for people in the higher ed system who replicate the status quo, who don't promote innovation, who don't rock the boat, who keep the trains running on time, and who don't challenge the established order of things. But Steve, if we are going to, you know, if we're going to change the fact that any system is perfectly designed to get the results it's getting right now, which you and I are agreeing are not adequate, what are we going to have to do to produce more people who are higher educators, but who are more likely to practice innovation? For example, I want to ask you if you, as a program officer, are thinking about how you could not so much change institutions, but change us, the way we think and the way we work. I had the privilege as a young man of getting a faculty job at a university where they invested a lot of money and time and effort in changing me, in developing me. But I don't think my experience was typical in that regard. But so, what are we going to have to do to produce more innovators, Steve? The people that could come knocking on your door and you would say, I know I'm not legally, I don't invest in people. I give grants to organizations, but I'm going to invest in this person's work. What are you looking for? What do you want to be able to look for?
How come all these questions are really hard? How come I have no softball questions?
You give me a softball question.
I'm just kidding. It's a great question. And I honestly have no expertise in this area, but I do know my colleagues at UCMC do. They invested early on in some fellowship programs, some professional development programs in career and technical education. You know, the first president of ECMC, Peter Taylor, was very interested, I think, in the ways in which higher education could be a better provider of job training. Now, it's always been in the recipe book, particularly at community colleges, but maybe devalued in certain ways. I mean, maybe devalued in the sense that we always keep thinking about the baccalaureate when the fact of the matter is many students either aren't interested or don't need it. So what they did at ECMC was create a program which, you know, brought the imprimatur of this particular kind of training, this particular kind of focus to a wider perspective, a wider view. And the idea there was very clearly was this is also always has been a key aspect of what higher education is all about, post-secondary education is all about. And so, yes, you're right, John. We don't invest in people per se, but we do want to invest in ways that transform the higher education ecosystem and allow it, you know, provide it with more degrees of freedom to do things beyond the sort of traditional. We both come from the traditional framework. We both work from that, and there's a lot of good to speak of that. But post-pandemic, right now, I think higher education is really going to have to pivot. Not to abandon some of the successful projects, but to understand that its value and its necessity is key to making this country go economically, but also culturally.
Steve, one of the benefits I always get out of listening to you, talking with you, is you make me think about certain experiences or events in American history that I understand, but maybe I don't think often enough about in terms of how they affect us. So you have explained to me previously and to others who will listen to you why transfer is so difficult in this country, because it literally was designed not to happen at all. We didn't want people. We created what were called terminal programs. God, what an awful concept, right? So I'm wondering, are there certain things at work in higher education right now which you would be willing to remind us we could learn from our history, maybe how to go about these and why we ought to? Are there lessons from how we got the Civil Rights Act through this country, Medicare, the Higher Education Act, that maybe we ought to try again?
Oh, great, great question. Actually, slight book plug. Eileen and I wrote a book, it was a couple of years ago now, Beyond Free College. And our sort of historical resonance there was post-World War II. We were just coming, in the writing of the book, we wrote it actually in the middle of the pandemic, which is, at least in my life, the most, I hope, the most transformative event. And we looked back to post-World War II and the GI Bill. And there again, the world had gone through an enormous tumult. Individuals, you know, policy planners had thought, wow, all these GIs are coming back. How are we going to invest in them? How are we going to invest in them? And so in the same sense, we believe the pandemic was also this key moment for reinvestment in higher education. And a couple of reasons why. Number one, I don't think we ever really believed that higher education could pivot as well as it did pivot in terms
and
of
so trying. So rapidly. We closed campuses in a week and went down, faculty governance went down the tubes.
Moved as quickly as they could, but we also appreciated that you know, the digital divide was not only real, it was critical. I mean, students now cannot access post-secondary education without having some broadband. I mean, it just isn't going to happen. But it also fuels the potentiality of higher education to realize that in that pandemic moment, we have the wherewithal to be able to accommodate many more students effectively. What I fear, John, is that realization is seeping away, that we are falling back into our rather traditional modes of providing education and not really appreciating the fact that we have only this short moment to remake ourselves effectively. And so for us in writing that book, it was sort of the GI moment. Yes, let's invest in those. Again, here we felt like, yes, coming out of a pandemic, here is the time to build on what we've learned during that period and go forward with it. And I hope that we do.
Well, I do too. Now, speaking of hope, I'm going to ask you to conclude with this. You confess to me that you have, and I'm not your agent. That's an interesting fantasy. What would I do if I were your agent? I have some ideas about that, Steve, but that's another conversation.
All right, we'll do that another time.
You confess to me that over the Christmas holidays, you and Eileen wrote something that I can only describe, and I haven't read it, but I have reason, what I know about it suggests to me that it's optimistic. You've got some good news. Will you please give us some good news?
Well, the over the break, Eileen and I, like I think all of us in higher ed, were kind of depressed with all the sort of bad news that was occurring in the fall, leading up to, I think, that congressional skewering of three higher education presidents, and we were concerned that higher education was, I don't know, I mean, some of it's deserved, John, clearly, but if you've worked in a field for that long, you also know good things are happening as well. So. Yeah. We came up with 24 positive things that occurred in 2023, and it's in Higher Education Dive, and I think you can just Google that. It came out on Friday, and what we attempted to do simply was, at least from our perspective, come up with 24 things for 2024 that were positive. And so you're going to see some good things in there. You know, enrollment is up. Yeah, enrollment's up slightly. It's maybe not as much as people want, and yet enrollment is up. Other issues, like we're seeing better connections between higher education and work. Higher education's trying to do a better job of showing what the value of higher education is for students who want to go directly into the work world. So it was in that vein. We didn't want to be Pollyanna about it, but we also want to acknowledge that there are good things happening. So whether you agree with our 24 or not, for us at least, it was an experience that allowed us to take for a moment and say, yes, we've got a lot of challenges, but you know what? It's an extraordinary system, and there are a lot of extraordinary people in it doing good work every day.
Well, I hope that some of us, I plan to. You say it came out on Friday, is that right?
Yeah, I think Friday. It was on the 31st, so Thursday or Friday. Yeah, Higher Education Dive. Yeah.
Well, Steve, I want to ask you in conclusion here to tell people how they could contact you if they want to. Does the foundation allow that? Can they write you?
Oh, yeah, by all means. Oh, listen, the foundation's wonderful. I mean, we have an open, what we call LOI process, letter of introduction, letter of interest, just on our website, ecmc.org. Take a look at our website. Take a look at our strategic framework. Take a look at the things that we're likely to fund. Reach out to me. I'm at SHANDEL at ECMC.org. And we love to talk with folks. In my particular sphere of influence, I'm very focused.
Ask you easy questions, right?
Yeah.
Folks who ask you easy questions, right?
Exactly. And we are, you know, we're very much open to hearing from folks, hearing about their ideas. So it's been a great job. I'm really enjoying my work there. Not because I've done anything particularly important, but because they have a leadership team and a board of directors that I think is squarely focused on equity, squarely focused on closing completion gaps, squarely focused on making investments that can scale across the United States to improve higher education, especially for underserved learners.
Well, Steve, on behalf of all our present and future listeners to these conversations, I want to thank you. I hope some of them will follow up with you, if only to have a conversation, get some
Absolutely.
Advice, get some feedback from you. And I know I have profited from that. And, you know, I'm so glad we have these virtual resources, but gosh, I'd love to be on a campus where you were down the hall and I could walk down and bounce an idea off you. I guess I could. I could just do it by email. But
just give me a call. You got my number. Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to do that as well, John.
I do have your number in more ways than one. Thank you so much, Stephen Handel of ECMC.
My pleasure. Thank you, John. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute, and we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.